Good morning. I hope you'll forgive me for this, but our very first worship song, Sovereign of the Sea, gosh, that took me back, reminded me of this true story of my uncles, Pat and Mike. When they were just lads, their own uncle, Seamus Ryan, said to them one day, boys, when I'm old, I want you to bury me at sea. Will you promise you'll bury me at sea? And the boys, being good boys, said, you betcha, Uncle Seamus, we sure will. So the day comes when Seamus Ryan kicks the bucket, and he passes on, and the boys launch out in their curragh, which is Irish for a little sailboat, and they take Uncle Seamus's body, and away they go. And they row out for a bit, and they row out for a bit, and they row out for a bit, and Mike says, so what do you think, Pat? Do you think it's deep enough here? So Pat says, I'll see. So he flips over the side of the curragh, and the water's only up to his knees. He goes, oh, no, Mike, we've got to go further out, much further out. So they row, and they row, and they row. And Pat hops over the side again, and this time it's up to his chest. Oh, we've got to go much further, Mike, much further. So they row, and they row, and they row, and they row, and they row. Finally, they're out there, and Mike says, what do you think now, Pat? We've rowed and rowed and rowed. Do you think this is far enough to bury Uncle Seamus? So with that, Pat hurls himself over the side of the curragh and disappears into the water. And there's no sign of him, not even bubbles coming up. Finally, Uncle Mike's getting in quite a stir, looking around, looking everywhere. And then here comes Pat, bursting up through the top of the water, whew, gasping for breath. And Mike goes, well, is it deep enough here for you, Pat? And he goes, it is. This'll do. Now hand me the shovel. Hand me the shovel. It's going to bury him under the sea. Okay, burial at sea. Burial at sea. That's one that sticks with you like a good protein. That will nurture you the rest of the day. And there's two connections, not one, but two connections to this morning's text. And I double dog dare you to find them, all right? Anybody that finds them, come to me after the service. Last week, Eric started us on a series of messages using the Psalms of Ascent. If you have a Bible or if you want to take out the Bible or just curious, they're in the book of Psalms. If you're not familiar with the Bible, you just look at the table of contents. You'll find Psalms in the Old Testament. There's 150 Psalms, but the Psalms of Ascent were short Psalms that the Hebrew pilgrims chanted as they went up to Jerusalem. And it's Psalms 120 to 134. There's 15 Psalms, 120 to 134. Today we're going to look at Psalm 124. But as Eric coached us last week to think about this collection, he said that the Psalms of Ascent help us to think about our spiritual lives. The Psalms of Ascent call to mind the pilgrimage of these Hebrews as they made their way up to Jerusalem. And as they journeyed, they would go there to celebrate, to remember the great acts of what God had done for his people. The whole book of Psalms, including the Psalms of Ascent, also serves as a prayer book for all people who want to follow the living God who created us and gives us life and loves us. And they serve as a way for us to remind ourselves and to mark our way through our own pilgrimage. Eric mentioned a book that we're using to help us on this series, written by Eugene Peterson 20 or 25 years ago. It's a Christian classic now called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And in that book, Peterson remarks that these songs of ascent are also metaphors. I mean, they're anchored in history, in the real experience of the Jews of old or the Hebrew people of old. But they're also containers of points of insight, points of spiritual light and truth, if you will, which can help us in our own journey. And they're a perfect setup for our own Jacob's Well pilgrimage in the middle of August. Peterson says, these psalms are useful to you and to me because they help us to undo. They help you and me undo our propensity for a hurried life. You and I live in a world of quick fixes, instant gratification, immediate results. But that isn't the spiritual life. That isn't real life. It's almost pretend life. And we all develop an unnatural dependency upon quickness. Well, the Psalms of Ascent help us to get back to a real pacing about life, the kind of pacing where we don't actually miss the life God intends for us to have. Like all 150 Psalms, the 15 Psalms of Ascent are prayers. And we need to remember that prayer, like I said 2 weeks ago, is a mutual conversation. It's a conversation between you and your Creator, between you and the source of your life, between you and your Father in heaven, a conversation between you and your Father over matters that concern both of you. But I ran across a quote this week, a great quote from a Jewish writer and scholar named Abraham Heschel. And I want you to think about this quote as we get ready to go to the text this morning. Heschel wrote, "Prayer is our humble answer to the inconceivable surprise of living." Let that quote roll around in your heart and maybe in your soul a little bit. Just think about it and think about the words of it. Prayer, that conversation that you have, is a humble answer. It's a response of humility. It's a growing humility when we really consider the nature of our lives and the nature of life. Prayer becomes that humble answer that is the best and only answer or response. A conversation with our Creator, because it is inconceivable on our own that we would be here. What do I mean by that? Which one of us in this room thought ourselves into existence? Which one of us conceived of ourself before ourself came to be? And so we find ourselves here. And the spiritual journey, a robust journey, is one of unpacking the inconceivable surprise, the truth, the wonder of being alive and belonging to God. So having said that, let's look at Psalm 124. Let's read it together, and then as our custom, we'll discuss it together. "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when people rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. Then the flood would have swept us away. The torrent would have gone over us, and over us would have gone the raging waters. Blessed be the Lord, who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we have escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth." Okay, as those slides cycle around, what do you see? What do you think about as we read that this morning? Yeah, the comment is that snare, that whole idea of being caught, not to over-spiritualize it, but our sin is a snare, isn't it? But in this psalm, what it's testifying to is that the snare is broken. It doesn't even work anymore. It can't function to encapsulate us or catch us. Yeah, good. Anyone else? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just like a gospel song almost. Say it again. If the Lord hadn't been on our side, say it again. If the Lord hadn't been on our side. Good comment. Yeah, yeah. Good. Anyone else?
To their teeth, for example. Like, if you're somebody who is saying that, you seemingly being given as prey to somebody's teeth or to your sin's teeth, you certainly don't feel the deliverance in that moment.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's obviously after the delivery and the testimony to what has happened.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Thomas' comment is that this psalm couldn't have been written unless the experience had been real. I mean, that's part of your comment. But in the moment of the experience, you're not feeling the deliverance. You've got teeth, you know, grabbing your flesh. Is that fair? Yeah, good comment. Yeah, anyone else? Yeah. Yeah, the comment is that idea of the flood, the raging torrent coming over us. Well, that happens geographically in that area. Flash floods come along at a surprising rate of speed. But also in the history of the Hebrew people, having walked through the Red Sea on dry ground and having seen God's deliverance and his act in history, that's a very real piece of their history. So they're speaking literally as well as metaphorically. Yeah, yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
I was just thinking about how the psalmist clearly feels like rescued, and I'm wondering how many times in my life I've like felt the feeling of being rescued by God. I know that many times, like when I'm uncomfortable, I pray to God, you know, save me because I'm uncomfortable. But once I'm made comfortable again, I don't know that I'm feeling like rescued. I think I'm feeling like, oh, I'm glad that's over. But I don't know if I give God the credit, I guess, in the same way the psalmist does.
Yeah. The comment is, how many times has the commenter or any of us felt actually the idea of rescued, that we were literally rescued? We might go through periods of duress or discomfort or severe discomfort even and pray for relief, and when it comes, we might say, oh, I'm glad it's over, but is that really the same as actually having been rescued out of the jaws of a beast, for instance, or out of a raging flood? Yeah, great comments. Well, you guys are on this psalm. It's a short psalm, just 8 verses, isn't it? But it's... like all the Psalms of Ascent, chantable and short and easy to memorize and useful, it's a testimony, like some of you picked up. It's not an argument. It's not laying out the case of, hey, here's how God really works when we have difficult things. Here's what you can count on God to do, or here's how you get God to do it, or anything like that. It's not instructing. It's testifying. As a people, this is what we have seen. We have had opposition. We have had this. We have had that. And we've seen that God is faithful. Another thing about this psalm is that it makes the thinking prayer look at the dark realities of life. Now, as the pilgrims, if you want to call them that, would be making their way up to Jerusalem, and from any vantage point where they were living, Jerusalem was at a higher altitude. So even if they're coming from the north and heading to Jerusalem in the south, they're still going up. As you go up, it's geographically natural, and as you're thinking about praising God and the encounters you'll have in the temple and with all the others in the spiritual community of the nation gathering to worship, you're thinking about casting your eyes upward, about looking up into the realm of the Shemayim or the heavens where God lives. And this psalm takes you the opposite direction, doesn't it? It takes you down into the depths. It takes you down into the dark realities of life. It makes us focus on those places where humans are engulfed in danger, or where we lose our way, or where we are prone to always want to seek an escape. Like one of our commenters said, when life's difficult, even if it's not that difficult, we want it to be over. We want to move through this piece of the story quickly. We want the escape hatch. But there are times in life when it grabs us and there is no escape. I was thinking about this psalm this week, and one of you that commented on it mentioned that the snare can be our own sin. And there's at least 4 different ways or 4 different realms from which difficulties can come to human beings, right? There's that sin disorder within myself. There's that aspect of me that actually creates difficulty for myself. Do you know what I mean? And so the things that I say, choices I make, the way I live my life, I can create my own snares, if you will. But then there's a sin and the disorder in other people, and other people can create difficulties for us, make choices, whether it's leading organizations or busting open oil wells or doing other things. We can create situations where other people are impacted, and so disorder and suffering happen because of the choices or the sin or the disorder in others' lives. There's a general disorder in the world. As good as the world is, as wonderful as the world is, as much as it is God's creation, it's a disordered realm right now. And then there's rebellion in what the Bible calls the cosmos, that whole spiritual envelope that surrounds this rock that we live on. And so in all of these spheres, my life, our life, the world as it's organized and as it is in kind of the writhing of a disappointment and disagreement and rebellion with God, and then the cosmos itself, there are all kinds of ways in which a human being can find themselves engulfed in a flood, snared by a beast, captured in a cage. Do you follow? And Psalm 124 says, we've seen this. This has been reality. This is human life. But God is able to bring us through it and to free us from it. It's a testimony to him. Pam and I are reading a book a friend recommended by Richard Rohr, Everything Belongs. That's a little liberal and expansive on my part. Pam is reading a book and shared with me some quotes. I should have said that at 9, but Pam's here at 11, and it's very important you understand what a great team we are. And so Pam shared this fantastic quote, I thought it was, from a 14th century Christian mystic named Julian of Norwich. She's a person that Rohr describes as somebody who had the ability to see contemplatively in an advanced way. She could see contemplatively in an advanced way. She could live with paradox and unanswered questions, immense inner conflicts and theological contradictions, and yet still trust God and live in peace. It may have been because of her learning, or it might have been because of her solitude. It could have been because of her gender, and it might have been some other factors that contributed to her spirituality. But Julian of Norwich, 14th century mystic, is a fantastic source of God-given wisdom. So Rohr quotes Julian of Norwich as saying, first there is the fall, and then there is the recovery from the fall. But both are the mercy of God. Think about that for a minute. First there is the fall, and then there is the recovery from the fall, but both are the mercy of God. Rohr goes on to say, maybe you can't believe that until the second half of life. Healthy spirituality causes us to embrace all of life as lived in God. A robust, a growing faith, a dealing with Jesus on his terms, an increasing conversation with the Holy Spirit causes us to move to a place where, for those of us who've had the privilege of walking with the Spirit, we come to see that even in the bad times, now maybe especially in the bad times, there are things to be seen, lessons to be learned, saving to be experienced that cannot happen any other way. In another place in the same book, Rohr quotes 20th century French philosopher and Christian mystic Simone Weil. Simone Weil said, it is grace that forms the void inside of us, and it is grace alone that can fill the void. And then Rohr goes on to write, grace leads us to the state of emptiness, to that momentary sense of meaninglessness in which we ask, what is it all for? I don't want to wake up tomorrow. What I'm suggesting is that in the context of Psalm 124, that there is grace in the struggle, that grace is even the source of the struggle. It's written, all things belong to God. Well, what does that mean, all things belong to God? Rohr goes on in his book to relate the recent episode he just had with a new widow who is saying to him that she did not want to live anymore. Anybody in here who's lost a spouse or a child, someone terrifically close to them, you know that sense of yawning despair and emptiness, that hopelessness of a future existence that could possibly be preferable. She told him she didn't want to live anymore. How could life ever be good again? He told her, someday the immense, bottomless pit of pain she was in would go away. And then he says this, there's no way you can know that. You have to simply trust me. You just have to believe it. You can't know it yet. She said, I'll trust you. He goes on to write this. And I put up this quote because for some of you, you've not experienced the yawning chasm of pain yet. But you walk with people who do. You're part of community. Remember, Psalm 124, the scriptures are written to a community. It's us together. We're in this together. So even if you're not struggling, it doesn't strike you. It's striking the person next to you. So Rohr says, it should be the work of Christians who believe in the Paschal mystery. Stop there. Paschal mystery. Funny church language for the Jesus event, the Jesus death and resurrection, okay? Who believe in the Paschal mystery to help people when they are being led into the darkness and the void. The believer has to tell those in pain that this is not forever. There is a light, and you will see it. This isn't all there is. Trust it. Don't try to rush through it. We can't leap over our grief work, nor can we skip over our despair work. We have to feel it. That means that in our life we have some blue days or dark days. Historic cultures saw it as the time of incubation, transformation, and necessary hibernation. It becomes the sacred space, Rohr writes, and yet this is the very space we avoid. When we avoid darkness, we avoid tension, spiritual creativity, and finally transformation. We avoid God who works in the darkness, where we are not in control. And maybe that is the secret. To me, there it is, the wonder of God, the wonder of faith, the wonder of Jesus, the wonder of what this thing is all about, the wonder of you and me getting up this morning and having another day at it. That in our darkness, he will show us light. In our being caged and caught, he will give us freedom. In our being hated by others, he will hold us close to his own heart. Eugene Peterson wrote, we speak our words of praise in a world that is hellish. We sing our songs of victory in a world where things get messy. We live our joy among people who neither understand nor encourage us. But the content of our lives is God, not humanity. We're not scavenging in the dark alleys of the world, poking in its garbage cans for bare subsistence. We're traveling in the light toward God who is rich in mercy and strong to save. It is Christ, not culture, that defines our lives. It is the help we experience, not the hazards we risk, that shapes our days. As I said earlier in this message, this psalm makes the thinking prayer look at how hard life can be, how dangerous it is to be human. Even while on the path of spiritual pilgrimage, where human thinking would say, focus on the heights, this song makes us look into the depths, into those places where human beings are engulfed in danger, where we lose our way, where we always seek an escape, but there is no escape. For those who have a connection with the Lord, there is in fact no need for escape. The Lord is the one who has not given us his prey. He meets you in that place of trouble. He meets me in that space of chaos. And he shows us things we couldn't see any other way. Trust is key to pilgrimage. Amen. Three is a good number in the Bible. So we've had two female Christian mystics. Let's hear from a third. Would you recite from me St. Teresa of Avila's words as we head to the communion table? Let nothing disturb you, nothing frighten you. All things are passing. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Nothing is wanting to one who possesses God. God alone suffices. Amen.